Eat Drink Indie Radio is powered by eatdrinkindie.com. Eat local, drink local, eat drink indie. Drink Indie Radio on WFYI HD2 The Point. I'm your host, Jolene Katzenberger. I am so glad you're joining us today here on Eat Drink Indie Radio because we're having a little celebration. It's our third anniversary here on WFYI. Honestly, I can't believe it's been 3 years that we've been bringing you interviews with local chefs, restaurateurs, farmers, food artisans, and all sorts of local food advocates. But it has been great talking with so many people. So many that are dedicated to making Indianapolis and its food culture something to be proud of. We've seen a lot accomplished in the past 3 years, and we've seen Indianapolis get plenty of national attention for our growing local food scene. And we've seen a lot of growth. Growth in restaurants and farmers markets and in locally made products. We've also seen some challenges, though, especially challenges related to growth. We've seen a lot of restaurants open in the past few years, true, but we've also seen some close. But it remains an exciting time here on the Indianapolis food scene, and we look forward to bringing you more great conversations about local food. And today's show focuses on two aspects of our food scene, the challenges facing farmers and the challenges facing chefs and restaurateurs. First, we'll be talking today with local food advocate Sherry Duggar, Media and Outreach Director for Indiana Farmers Union, an organization that serves farmers both large and small. Sherry tells us about the upcoming Indiana Farmers Union Conference, which includes a screening of the documentary Farmers for America. Sherry also talks with us about the challenges facing small farmers today and about her own experiences in moving to the country and creating the Duggar Family Farm with her husband Randy in rural Shelby County. And then we'll revisit an interview from this past summer with chef and restaurateur Neil Brown, a James Beard Awards semifinalist, and one of Indy's most high-profile chefs. We talked with Neil about the current restaurant environment and the challenges he's faced in opening and closing restaurants. We also talked with him about his soon-to-open restaurant, Yukio, a seasonally focused Japanese-inspired restaurant that will be opening next month. So stay with us for more here on Eat Drink Indie Radio on WFYI and WFYI.org. Local food, it all comes back to the farmer. That's the beginning, right? Where it all starts. You can't have restaurants focused on local food or farmers markets full of fresh produce without the farmers who are growing it all. But it's not an easy time for farmers, and it's probably more accurate to say that it has never been easy for farmers. So much of what affects their work is out of their hands. Weather, prices, the demands of fickle consumers, and still farmers continue. And farming continues to draw people. One such person is Sherry Duggar, Media and Outreach Director for the Indiana Farmers Union. A former journalist, Sherry found herself drawn to farming, and in the past few years, she and her husband Randy have launched a small operation on the Duggar Family Farm in rural Shelby County near Morristown. She also operates a farm store there, where she sells products from other small farms around the state. We're talking with Sherry today about her work with the Indiana Farmers Union and its upcoming conference, November 17th and 18th, which will include a screening of the documentary Farmers for America. Sherry tells us about the conference, what will take place, and how you can attend. First, tell me a little bit about Indiana Farmers Union, in case people aren't familiar with that name and that entity. What is it?
Indiana Farmers Union is housed under the National Farmers Union. They are here in Indiana to promote and support family farmers and ranchers to be able to provide education, legislation, and cooperative development for those farmers. So we do everything in terms of giving them workshops, classes on food safety or anything like that that they might need. We also support cooperative development. So if there's a set of farmers that want to work together to build a cooperative, that we will help them do that, and we can find ways to help them do that. We also provide legislative support for them if they need it. If they have issues that they're dealing with on a personal level, we can take that to the state level. We can also take that to the federal level with the National Farmers Union.
Now, how long has the organization been in Indiana?
It was there's a long history there. It was sort of first established at the beginning of the 1900s, but officially we say it was established in 1955.
Mm-hmm. So it's been around a long time. It doesn't seem to have had a very high profile lately. You know, is that something you're working to raise?
Yes, we're trying
to
rebuild it. Absolutely. It has been active, but it hasn't been as active as the leaders would have wanted it to be. So we are trying to get it more involved, the union itself to be more present, to be more in the farmer's eye, to let them know,
sure,
that it's here, the union is here, they will support family farmers in any way that they need possible. You just need to, you know, contact us, become a member, let us know what you're dealing with, let us know what you need.
Now, are there members in, is it a county membership? Is it statewide?
A statewide membership. Whenever you join the Indiana Farmers Union, you're automatically a member of the National Farmers Union as well. So there are counties that you can actually develop chapters if you wanted to under the Indiana Farmers Union. So if you had a group in your county that you wanted to band together and do your own thing underneath the umbrella, then you could do that as well.
Now, you have a conference coming up here
in
Indiana?
Yeah. Every year they have an annual convention or conference that they hold. This is a free event for their members as well as anyone who's interested in becoming a member, wants to know more about the Indiana Farmers Union. It starts actually on November 17th. We have a farm tour at Boyer Farms in Converse, Indiana, and that's I don't know if you're familiar with Healthy Hoosier Oil.
Oh, well,
that
sure.
Product. Okay,
why?
So
I have seen that product.
They're a sixth-generation farm, and they actually sort of diversify their offerings and have branched out into sunflowers and canola oil.
Right.
And so we're going to go tour that farm on November 17th. And then
very
on November 18th, we have our actual convention where we're going to have speakers and a film screening, et cetera.
Now, tell me about the film a little bit, about the documentary.
It's called Farmers for America, and it just actually had its national debut here in Indianapolis during the FFA convention. And it is Graham Merriweather is the director and the editor of that film, and he also produced some years back a film called American Meat. But he basically went around the country, spent years, I believe, traveling the country and talking to farmers, beginning farmers, established farmers, all types of family farmers who were doing all kinds of different farms, you know, from commodity farming, corn and soybeans, to doing small diversified urban farms. So he talked to them about, you know, their issues, what they're dealing with, access to land, to food, to credit, everything, every problem that they could possibly have as new and beginning farmers and as established farmers.
And so that's what the film explores, is these issues facing family farmers?
Yes, family farmers.
Does it call for, you know, is there a call to action? Is there something that the film is, promoting that should be done?
Well, I think the film explores the idea that there are three or four major companies that produce most of the meat that we consume in the world. And I think that conglomeration of, power is not good for our family farmers. They don't have a lot of voice at a legislative level. They don't have a lot of voice, in terms of being able to get fair prices for their food and their commodities and being able to really speak up for themselves and be heard. And so I think that's kind of an underlying, there's a problem here. Our food system is broken, and we have to find ways to support our family farmers.
And I suppose finding out about these problems and these issues, is certainly a place to start.
Yes, absolutely. The discussion needs to be had, and we need to continue that discussion.
And so that'll take place,
film screening is going to take place on November 18th at the convention, and we're going to have it at Taxman Brewing Company in Fortville.
Mm-hmm. Now, what will people, if they attend the convention, what sort of, what can they expect? What will the convention be like?
It's basically just one day. It's going to be from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. And we are going to have, food and a full buffet that'll be there for everybody who attends. It's a free event. But we're going to have speakers. Joe Maxwell he used to be a senator in Missouri, and he's also a hog farmer out there at Maxwell Farms. He is a farming and food advocate that I've had the pleasure of meeting this past year. And he, on a federal level, he is really outspoken, really, a heavy hitter in terms of an advocate for family farmers and for being able to speak up for them and get that voice into the areas that where it's needed in our in our government. So Joe is a very dynamic speaker. He's going to be our keynote speaker, and he's going to come into town for that event. We have Tom Giesel, who is also a historian for the National Farmers Union. He's going to come and talk about some of the cool history of the National Farmers Union, which dates back many, many years. And then we have Katie Moyer. She's with Kentucky Hemp Works, I believe, and she'll be talking about industrial hemp and what they're doing in Kentucky.
We've been talking with Sherry Duggar, local food advocate and the media and outreach director for the Indiana Farmers Union. We'll be right back with more from Sherry here on WFYI and WFYI.org. Jolene Katzenberger, and we are back today here on Eat, Drink, Indie Radio talking farming with Sherry Duggar, Media and Outreach Director for the Indiana Farmers Union. That organization will host its annual convention in Fortville, Indiana, November 17th and 18th, but the organization works year-round to support farmers, and that includes small urban farmers as well as larger commodity operations. It's a mission that Sherry has taken to heart, and she's working to raise awareness of the organization and what it can offer. As a small farmer herself, Sherry has participated in educational programs offered by the Indiana Farmers Union, and today she tells us more about her work with the organization, the issues facing farmers, and how Indiana Farmers Union aims to help. So tell me a little bit about your work with the Indiana Farmers Union and maybe how you became involved in that.
Well, I was actually courting them. I was a journalist, full-time journalist, as you know, and I was speaking with Indiana Farmers Union for a publication that we did called Farm Indiana. And when I left the journalism field, I immediately kind of hooked up with the Indiana Farmers Union because I believed in their mission and what they were doing. And it really spoke to me in terms of something that I wanted to do for moving forward for me and my career. So I'm the media and outreach director. I am out there trying to grow membership. I'm trying to let farmers know that it exists because, as you mentioned,
right,
that it hasn't had a lot of presence. And a lot of people just didn't know that it was out there and that they could use it, that there were resources there to be able to help them grow their farm businesses.
Now, what do you do? How do you accomplish that? I suppose, you know, talking about the upcoming conference is one way.
Yeah, absolutely. In terms of getting the word out.
Mm-hmm.
I just came from a meeting with Emily Toner from Purdue Extension. Mm-hmm. So we're going to actually sponsor the Indiana Small Farm conference that's coming up. We're going to actually, I myself, I'm going to administer scholarships for people to be able to go to that conference through the Indiana Farmers Union. So those types of things we do all the time. We get involved as in any way that we can with these conferences and with these events that are going on so that people can see the name, they can hear about what the union does, and they can understand that it is there for them.
Now, is it, you said, you know, for all sorts of farmers, but, you know, do you have, you know, a membership that spans, you know, from commodity farming all the
yes,
way down to
absolutely
small urban farms?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that is actually, I believe, they really understand, the National Farmers Union really understands. They have a Beginning Farmer Institute program, which really caters to those types of farmers that you mentioned, those smaller farmers, those urban farmers, you know, diversified farmers, sustainable farming. And they understand that that's kind of the way the future is going. You know, that's the way we really, the consumers want to eat that food that's grown on these small, diversified local farms. They want to buy locally. They want to support their local communities. And that's National Farmers Union as well as Indiana Farmers Union is in big support of that.
Now, is there some tension in there, you know, with the differing goals often of, you know, of the big guys and then the small guys?
I think that you'll find that a lot of the big guys don't feel very big.
Oh, no, that's interesting.
I think, you know, in terms of these farmers who are out there and working in commodities, I don't feel like, from what I've learned in this past year working with all sizes and all different types of farmers, they don't feel like they have a lot of options. The commodity farmers don't feel like that. The small farmers don't feel like that. They across the board, they feel like they're not being heard.
Oh, that's interesting.
These large corporate interests that are in agriculture are the ones that have all of that power and are able to speak and be heard at a federal level. So I think that across the board, there's a little tension here and there. There's discussion of GMOs versus non-GMOs. That sort of thing happens mm-hmm. at the larger national convention and stuff. But I think that across the board, you find that most of these farmers who are family farms trying to make a difference either in their communities or trying to just make a living, I don't feel like they feel like, you know, they're just trying to get by. They're trying to survive.
Now, what are some of the issues that they're facing today, you know, here in Indiana?
In terms of which types of farmers?
I guess I'm thinking mostly of the small farms,
okay.
You know, the small diversified farms, you know, that we see at farmers markets.
Yeah. Well, they have issues with access. Some of those small farmers don't, you know, they're not able to get into Whole Foods, for instance, unless they get certain certifications. They don't have access to market. They don't have access to maybe food safety training. They don't have access to knowledge about how to build their business, you know, correctly. Maybe they don't have that experience. They don't have access to land, which is very expensive. There's a lot of different, you know, or access to credit if they don't have a credit history. So there's a lot of barriers that exist with, if you want to grow food and you want to grow food and try to sell it to your community, it's honestly, it's very difficult.
But that's something we absolutely need.
Absolutely.
Right?
And we have to change it.
Now, how is Indiana Farmers Union and also the national organization, how are they trying to change that?
They're trying to educate their farmers. My husband and I are going through a program called the Beginning Farmer Institute, which is one of the best benefits to being a member that you can possibly get if you're a beginning farmer. They will send you around the United States on several different trips, and you'll be able to learn and network with other farmers who are doing those same things that you're trying to do or different things, and you can learn from the diversity. But they also bring in experts to be able to talk. I just went on one trip. It was in California, and they talked about, we had a meeting about insurance that explained all of the farm insurance that we might need, our risk management, everything that might happen on our farm.
Oh, my goodness.
So there's just things like that. The first one that we went to was in D.C. We got to go actually lobby on the Hill. We got to learn, you know, what that process is like. But we also got to talk about building your business model and you know, building and working in food co-ops and all those different things that are available. So there were just back-to-back classes the entire time during the trip, and farm tours as well.
And so these are opportunities that are available,
yes,
and out there,
absolutely,
to small
every
farmers?
Every year they get a new batch of new farmers that apply, and it's just a program. It's 95% paid for.
Oh, my goodness.
We buy a couple of meals here and there, but the rest of it, travel, everything is paid for, and they just give you this opportunity to go out there and learn.
We've been talking with Sherry Duggar, small farmer and media and outreach director for the Indiana Farmers Union. We'll be right back with more here on Eat Drink Indie Radio on WFYI and WFYI.org. There is certainly an appeal to the idea of farming, about moving to the country, getting back to the land, raising animals, and connecting with nature. That's a romanticized notion, to be sure, but it's one that continues to resonate, especially with urban residents. Even in the city, some of us feel drawn to raise bees or chickens or backyard gardens. But sometimes a backyard garden just isn't enough, and the big city lifestyle gives way to the different demands of living on a farm. That's what happened to former Indianapolis journalist Sherry Duggar, who now lives with her husband Randy and chickens, goats, and alpacas on a small family farm in Shelby County. Sherry works with the Indiana Farmers Union as media and outreach director, but she is also working at making a life on the farm, which includes a small farm store where she sells her own products as well as those from other small farms around the state. Sherry tells us about her path to farming and about the changes she's experienced along the way.
Tell me a little bit about your personal adventure in farming, because this is a different career path for you.
This is absolutely a different career path. So I'm on that learning curve as well. I have a big learning curve, and this year has been for me, I've really embraced the policy work and really learning how to lobby for these people. It just really speaks to me, and to lobby for animals as well. But I'm a journalist by trade. I've spent probably almost 20 years editing or writing of some sort, and it just happened. My husband and I moved out to the country a few years ago. I really sort of fell in love with gardening and growing my own food, and that, you know.
Now, you had a big garden in the city when you
lived
in town.
I had a big garden, yes, absolutely. I had a big garden in the city, and we lived in Garfield Park. And over time, I just felt drawn to the country. This is so different for me because I lived in New York City for a spell. So
you,
this
you
is
are a city girl,
different.
In your past
absolutely.
Lives, right?
And so, you know, moving out to the country, getting animals, we have goats and alpacas and chickens on our farm. It's called Duggar Family Farm. And
now this is in Shelby County?
In Shelby County, in Morristown, actually, mm-hmm. Right on the border. And that really... getting closer to animals and sort of learning, you know, about farming has really sort of spoken to me until I stopped eating meat. You know, I changed the way my own lifestyle. And we took in these animals as rescue animals. The goats are all rescues that, you know, likely would have been sold on the market for meat. And the alpacas came from a rescue and we eventually adopted them. So it's really sort of softened my heart toward animals and toward livestock and toward this food system that really forces meat down our throats, literally, as though we need it every day and we need this high percentage of it, which we don't. But that's a whole other conversation. But I believe it's really changed the way I look at how we feed ourselves and what is the best route to feeding ourselves environmentally, socially, physically, you know, for our health, et cetera. And so it's been a path that I couldn't even stop.
Oh,
you know,
my goodness.
If that makes sense. It's just something that I can't not do anymore.
So you live out in the country
mm-hmm.
on
very small farm.
A small farm. Uh-huh. Now, what do you raise there?
We have chickens. Mm-hmm. We sell eggs in our small farm store where we sell foods from 40 to 50 different makers around the state. And we have, like I said, the goats and the alpacas are there. We keep bees, but we don't take their honey. We just keep bees to support our pollinators because we desperately need those as well. So right now, and we just started microgreens. We're growing microgreens, and we're selling those to local restaurants and to people through the store. And that's a new venture, and we're about to get a high tunnel installed. So
now that's a type of greenhouse,
right?
Yes,
that's a type of plastic greenhouse actually available through the government. We got that through a grant program. So we're expanding as we go. We're still building out the farm and seeing where that leads us. But
well, now tell me a little bit about the farm store, because that's you hit an anniversary this year,
yeah,
right?
Actually, July was our first anniversary of the farm store. We opened it last July in 2016. That has been a really great opportunity for us to not only promote local food and local makers of food and you know, products, all kinds of different products, jams, jellies, produce, cheeses, meats, everything.
So this is a freestanding small
yes,
building on your farm,
uh-huh.
and people can come
yes,
and
they
shop.
Can come. Uh-huh. Yep. And we put together food baskets for Christmas. We were really busy last Christmas, so I'm going to start promoting that to give gift baskets of locally made foods to folks. But it has been a really great opportunity for us to get to know our neighbors, for us to have people out to the farm so we can sort of talk about what we're doing and why we're doing it and what's important to us and those ideals as well.
Now, you have talked in the past about access in rural communities
yes.
to fresh food. Now,
yeah.
talk a little bit about that as a motivating factor.
Yeah, absolutely. I think a lot of our farmers who are actually growing food aren't feeding their families well, unfortunately, because they're not making enough money to do so. And that's the stark reality is that it's just there isn't a lot of access to real whole food in rural communities. Our rural communities are really suffering, and they have been for quite some time. And the reason is because of our industrial agriculture and the move toward that. It does not support rural communities. It doesn't support local farmers and small farmers who can then give back to their communities, who can put that money back into, you know, in four or five different ways into their local community. So our high schools in rural areas are dying. Our hospitals in rural areas are going away because there's just not enough money there.
Are there solutions to the problem that you can see, you know, in your role with the Farmers Union and your role as a small farmer yourself?
I believe that we absolutely have to get people. The solution is the consumer, to be honest. The consumer is who creates that demand and who will change the system. And until we get everyone to understand how important it is to pay an extra dollar if you can to get that food locally made and to be able to put that back into your community, you know, until we get everyone to understand that and to be on board with that, we're not going to change anything.
Now, have you seen progress? I mean,
yeah.
Tell me how long you've been farming and how long this career path change has been taking place.
Well, we moved to our farm in 2012. We purchased the property in 2012. Uh-huh. We moved in 2013. We had to spend a year restoring the property so that it was livable. So I have seen, as I have educated myself, because as an editor publishing a publication that was farm-oriented, I was able to learn a lot mm-hmm. and to see what was going on in the state. We have a lot of programs here. We have Purdue Extension is wonderful for what they do for our farmers, for our food system workers. They put on the Indiana Food Summit every year. They put on the Indiana Small Farm Conference every year and multiple other programs and workshops. So there's a lot of work being done. There's a lot of the Indy Food Council is involved. There's a lot of, you know, there's the People's Food Summit that happened this year in Marion County. There's a lot of work being done, but it's not enough. A lot of those food system workers don't buy as much local food as they should. A lot of the people who are in the system, you know, in this area where they're actually working to try to change things aren't able to even afford the things that they want to purchase.
And that's an ongoing issue.
Yeah.
You know, the availability of it. And the affordability.
The affordability, for sure. It's partly an educational process, but we have to find ways to either, I don't know if subsidies for small farmers will work. I don't know what that answer is that will fix the problems, but we have to absolutely consumer demand is what's going to change not only the ways of what small farmers do and their success or failure, but also it's going to speak to these big agribusinesses that are out there, and they're already doing it. They're co-opting the organic brands.
That is true.
They're co-opting the local, mm-hmm. you know, the word local in their food, regardless of whether it's local.
Right?
You know, they see what the consumer wants, and they're going to change because of it. So if you want your chicken raised humanely, then they're going to do that if they see there's dollars behind it.
So is there a way for people to get involved? I mean, you know, I would imagine to continue to support your farmers markets and
yes,
that sort
absolutely.
Of thing. Are there other things that the consumer can do?
There are organizations, you know, like the Purdue has these events that are there and they're open to anyone who's interested in those types of things. Slow Food Indy is a great organization that supports, you know, these concepts. I think Indiana Farmers Union, if you really want to support farmers, join it, you know, call me, find out ways that we can do stuff together. There's only one of me, you know, out there doing these things for media and outreach, and I would love to have help. You know, and I want to hear ideas too. You know, it's lovely to hear somebody who wants to be a part of something and wants to do something. We have local food, marketwagon.com. We have HoosierHarvestMarket.com, which I am actually on the board of. And those are locally, you know, made providers of food. I don't know what Market Wagon has now, but I think they've got like 100 different makers that you can purchase
from
online.
We've talked to them before.
Yeah. And
certainly.
They will be delivered, you know, all over the city. Hoosier Harvest Market has a great number of, you know, it's the only farmer-owned online co-op in the state. So, and that they supply that food and will deliver it to certain spots. So I think, you know, those are either areas where you can not only volunteer or work or get involved, but purchase from.
That's right. Your purchase power.
Yes.
To put that in the right direction to support, you know, what things you feel are important.
Absolutely.
So tell me again about the upcoming conference and how people can get more information about that.
They can go to our Facebook page, Indiana Farmers Union. I have two events that I've placed on there that has a lot of the details of both of those, the tour on Friday night and as well as the convention or conference on Saturday. They can go to IndianaFarmersUnion.org as well. The website will have information on there. Or they can just email IndianaFarmersUnion@gmail.com and reach me.
Well, that's terrific. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I appreciate it.
Thank you.
We've been talking with Sherry Duggar, small farmer and director of media and outreach for the Indiana Farmers Union. Look for the organization online at IndianaFarmersUnion.org or on Facebook. And you can also find the Duggar Family Farm on Facebook or at DuggarFamilyFarm.com. Talking today here on Eat Drink Indy Radio with chef and restaurateur Neil Brown, one of Indy's most high-profile chefs.
He came up through the ranks of local kitchens, opened restaurants for other owners, and has opened and closed some of his own as well. It's not an easy business, and today's challenging restaurant climate is making it even tougher. Neil tells us just how hard it is right now, what it's like to open and, yes, close a restaurant, and why he can't help but keep at it.
It's a tough time, right? I think everyone is feeling it. I have spoken with many of my sort of restaurateur counterparts across the city. And I think everyone's kind of feeling something. There's a little blip in the radar where we're sort of all kind of going, yeah, something's not right. I've heard lots of theories. I think some prevailing theories are that it's an adjustment in the market.
Right.
After
much growth, right?
After this significant growth we've had. I think some people have just flat out said, well, the restaurants weren't very good that closed, which I think is a little extreme because they were good restaurants. There are lots of theories, but I don't think it's even possible to say that it's all one thing. I think if there's one common sort of denominator that probably runs through all of the closings we've seen is cash, right?
Undercapitalization,
or just a lack of cash. Maybe it's not undercapitalization because maybe they went into their business with plenty of money, but businesses, restaurants particularly, consume cash cyclically. Right. Sometimes you're cash poor. Sometimes you're cash rich.
Oh, sure. So
it's seasonal.
A seasonal thing. So lack of cash is a very simple.
It can
Simple
be,
kind
yeah.
Of,
and, you know,
problem?
I think, you know, John Adams was quoted as saying he just didn't feel like he could look his investors in the eye and ask for another $100,000, right?
Now, how is that? You have dealt with this sort of situation for a long time. You have opened restaurants. You've
closed
restaurants.
More restaurants than most people around this town, yeah. Yeah.
So you have investors. So you must know what that feels like.
Yeah, it is awful. It is... you feel the failure. I mean, it washes over you. And it's not, when you close a restaurant, it's not like you just close the restaurant and you walk away.
Okay, so
it's not that tidy.
Talk a little bit about that, because we're referring to L'Explorateur, which was one of the trends setting the restaurants. It was, way out in front of the curve, I think, on a lot of food trends here in Indianapolis, doing some really incredible things. And yet, it closed.
And yet 2008 happened, right? And I do sort of attribute 2008 to the closure of L'Explorateur. Though, it's worth saying now, and in total fairness, we were undercapitalized. We were a classic example.
So that is, like you said, a classic example.
We didn't have the money to weather the storm. And that's what this is really all about, is having the cash to weather the storm and coming up with creative ways to weather the storm. You have to get creative. But to speak to actually closing a restaurant, it is not tidy. It's really messy. It feels bad. There's nothing about it except for the struggle. There's nothing good about it.
So it's when you stop struggling, right?
You feel this release. You feel this weight being lifted off your shoulders because you no longer have to go in every day and succumb to that pressure. The pressure is overwhelming when you're closing a restaurant. It's just overwhelming. It's almost intolerable.
The build-up to that?
Yeah, the build-up, because you're dealing with lots of vendors who are calling you and asking you for money, and they're demanding payment. You've got to be answering to your partners. If you have a bank involved, you got to be keeping the bank very much in the loop. You've got to be worrying about your family because chances are, as an entrepreneur, you're the first person that actually stops getting paid. So you're not having any personal income coming into your household. So the stress level is tenfold, right? It's coming at you from every direction. And this is not unique to a restaurant.
This is unique to an entrepreneur, small business owner. Right?
Yeah, yeah. So you're getting it from all directions. It's incredibly stressful. And it goes on for months because
Oh my goodness.
Because you have to you have to liquidate assets, right? You have to figure out if you're going to deliver the space back to the landlord in what condition, right? If there's a bank involved, the bank has to decide how best to liquidate the assets of the business. And you're responsible. If you're a good entrepreneur and you plan on living to fight another day, you're going to take it upon yourself to create a scenario where they are very comfortable with what you've left behind. You create an inventory of everything. So that means you're going through and doing all of that. So it's not tidy. It's
so
just
you
not
don't just
an easy,
cut and run.
You don't just cut and run. And some people have been able to do that. You know, I feel good that Craig and Scott at Long Branch and John both were able to sort of transfer their restaurants over to new ownership, because
that's right.
that transfer is actually pretty key, because that gets them off the hook from a lease standpoint. Some landlords, you know, if they've personally guaranteed these leases, the landlord has every legal right to come after you for the full value of the lease, and that means 5 years of paying maybe $90,000 a year, maybe $150,000 a year.
Oh, my goodness.
So, you know, if any new startup, entrepreneurial, sort of spirited chef most likely is going to have to sign a personal guarantee on a lease, and that is a legally binding contract.
So you are guaranteeing that lease will be paid for X, whatever the extent
until,
of the lease is.
And usually it's until someone leases the space. So, you know, in the middle of all of this, you become a broker and a leasing agent.
So you're
as
trying
well.
To find someone to take
you're
over the
market.
Space? Oh, my goodness.
Right. And then you have to convince someone why they should take it when you couldn't.
So they will succeed.
They will succeed
right.
when you couldn't. Right?
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. So it's very frustrating. It's really tough, really, really tough.
So you know what these people have been going through lately when we talk about some of the high-profile closures.
Oh, man. I just, you know, I've instant messaged these guys and the people that I know and just said, look, I'm really sorry. There's nothing you can really do to help people. But, you know, just to say I'm really sorry. And, man, that feels so insignificant to say that. It just feels so just... Those aren't strong enough words, right? I just wish there were other words, because that's your, you know, I'm sitting here with my son next to me here, but it's a loss. It's a personal loss, because it's your dignity. It is your identity, because that restaurant has been part of you for so long. It is part of you, and you're saying goodbye to that part of you, at least for the short time. And so it's tough. It's really, really tough. Yeah.
So why do people do it?
Because we love it. Every time I open a new restaurant, I say, this is the last restaurant I'm opening.
Now, how many have you opened?
Not as many as I've closed. No, that's
no,
not true.
That's not really true.
That's not true. I guess I've opened, what, five now? Five restaurants? And that's only my restaurant. So I've been involved
in
many,
right. You've
many
been
other
in the
openings
of other restaurants.
Yeah. And so, no, we do it because the challenge. We do it because...
do you do it because this is what you do?
It's what we do. I think there are chefs who sort of love to open restaurants like I do. And I do love restaurants. I mean, I love everything about a restaurant. And I think there are chefs that love being on the line. You know, I think the Greg Hardesty's and the Dave Talents of the world are their proudest moments are that those guys never miss a service, right?
Right.
So there's that kind of chef. One is no better than the other, but it's just a different philosophy, a different way of thinking.
And you like the opening, the challenges involved in all that? You know, the
worst part of it, yeah.
Right, the worst part of it.
Yeah, I don't love that part. I really, truly don't. I love restaurants, and I love when a restaurant is running smoothly.
Now, what's that like? Speak a little bit about when it's good, you know, because that must feed something.
Yeah, when it's good, it feels really good, you know, and that's when you can look around and when I talk about this, sometimes I talk about it in terms of golf, right?
Okay.
A great night at a restaurant is like a game of golf. It's like you really strike the ball well, and that one strike can get you through 3, 4, maybe 5 more holes before you need that next strike where it's just perfect, or not even just perfect, but just really good enough to propel you through the rest of the game, right? It's a little bit like that. When you have a night that's just on and it's and everything is falling into place and service is great, you just feel it. You feel it. Everyone feels it. The restaurant's got a vibe. It's got a buzz. The guests have a different vibe and a different buzz. That's what we all chase. I mean, that's literally what we're all chasing all the time.
We've been talking with chef and restaurateur Neil Brown of Pizzology, Stella, and the Libertine Liquor Bar. Stay with us for more from Neil about restaurant culture and his next restaurant, Yukio, when we're back here on Eat, Drink, Indie Radio. Chef and restaurateur Neil Brown of Pizzology in Carmel and Stella and the Libertine Liquor Bar downtown will soon be turning his attention to his next restaurant, Yukio. That project, a Japanese-inspired, seasonally focused restaurant, will be located at 49th and College Avenue in Indianapolis. We talked with Neil about the creative process, how he starts when thinking about a new restaurant or even a new menu, how he visualizes a dish, and how it all plays into creating Yukio.
Well, talk a little bit about the creative process when it comes to maybe all the way from envisioning a restaurant to creating a menu. Where do you start?
So, well, I'm a very visual learner.
You mean like drawing?
Pictures? No, yeah. Imagery. Mm-hmm. So I think in images. I taste visually. And so I tend to see flavor, right? Sometimes when I describe it to my wife, like I'm talking about how when I taste wine, I actually see kind of a heartbeat line.
Okay.
And acid and sweetness tend to go up and down on my sort of, and then, you know, if it's something that is a very, really great wine, it's not sharp at all. It's actually quite, it's more of a sloping sort of line.
I see it.
Yeah. So,
I see it, right? So I'm trying to see what you're describing,
yeah.
Which is a taste.
Yeah.
So that's interesting.
Yeah. Typically for me, if it looks like whatever you call it.
A heart rate monitor. Right.
The more it looks like that, probably the less I like that wine. The more smooth those lines are,
okay.
I tend to like those wines a little bit more. And so I taste food very much in the same way. Balance is key for me. I like balanced food. But the creative process for me is it starts with immersing myself into whatever it is that I want to sort of tackle, right? So this morning, I got up this morning and I laid in bed until probably too late, 9:30, while my wife was getting ready. I laid in bed and I literally watched YouTube videos of Japanese chefs making sushi, watched YouTube videos of guys making yakitori, and just immersed myself in video. And as I'm starting to turn my attention towards Yukio, I've watched every episode of Inaka on Chef's Table. So I'm just I start to seek out all of these sort of Japanese influences, right?
So this is in preparation for your next restaurant, Yukio.
For Yukio,
Japanese restaurant, Japanese inspired restaurant. How would you describe it?
Japanese inspired.
Okay.
Because I feel strongly that Japanese food is about time and place. It is a seasonal cuisine, and it is a cuisine that is identified very much by its place, right? Osaka makes very different food than Tokyo. So just like any other classic cuisine in any other country, you know, Rome is different than Naples, right? So time and place is very important, and so that's kind of how I'm approaching Yukio. We're lucky in the sense that we have ingredients in Indiana that speak very well to the Japanese sort of aesthetic and the flavor palette of Japanese cuisine. I feel like we can execute very, very well. I'm excited about it. I think we're approaching it in the right way.
Which is how?
You know, this is really cliche, but we're going to use Indiana ingredients to make, you know, Japanese food. But yet we're going to have sushi, right?
So now, is that an unusual juxtaposition? You know,
yeah,
a local farm-to-table restaurant that is not American food?
Yeah, it's weird. It's weird. But we're certainly not advertising this as a farm-to-table restaurant either.
That's one of those overused cliches, but you are going to focus on local ingredients.
Yeah. I mean, for us, it's a foregone conclusion, right?
Right. So we just assume that these days.
Yeah. We don't really talk about it. It's just part of it's part of our culture. So
right,
we don't really talk about it. So yeah, it is. It's weird. And I am conflicted, about this. And I've got to reconcile that. I've got to reconcile that somehow. And I will. I think through it a lot.
But you have a long history with Japanese cuisine, right?
Tell me a little bit
about your background.
Well, I was working with Greg Hardesty for 6 years, almost 6 years, until he fired me.
Now that was H2O
sushi,
right?
Legend has it that he fired me, but I might say that I quit. I'm not sure. We're not sure. No one can remember that night. That fateful evening. So, yeah. So doing, at the time. So that was Greg's slant at H2O was, it's called Nikkei mm-hmm. cuisine, right? And it's Peruvian-inspired Japanese food. And I always felt like Greg sort of gravitated towards that Nikkei-style sushi. And what I mean by that is he wasn't afraid to use some root vegetables. He wasn't afraid to use cilantro, certainly. Herbs were a really prominent sort of part of what he did from a sushi standpoint. And so I learned all that, and that was fascinating to me. That was his aesthetic. And we will definitely have our own aesthetic. We're going to focus a little bit more on wild foods, foraged foods. We've been working very closely, especially this summer. It's gotten very intense lately, working with three different foragers.
Oh, interesting.
Uh-huh. Yep, and so we did a dish a few nights ago for the ACLU dinner that I thought was it was a Stella dish, but secretly I was so happy about it because of what we were able to achieve from a Yukio standpoint. We did fried milkweed buds that were just delicious as this little crunchy garnish on this tartine. We pickled lily blossoms that were just delicious. And so, you do all these kinds of little things, that's kind of where my head is. We achieved a really, really, I thought, very special dish. I thought it was a great dish.
So how does that process continue as you envision the restaurant? I assume you'll be starting with the decor and, mm-hmm. How it's going to look and how it's going to feel and concurrently with the menu. So how does that process continue?
Well, like I said, I've stopped designing restaurants. I have this picture in my head. I always develop this picture in my head when I'm opening a new place, right? And I've learned that I have to let go of that because I've been disappointed. Sometimes I'm so fixated on the mental image that I can't get past the practicality of what the place needs to do, right? And so I've made that mistake several times. And so with this one, I'm just sort of entrusting Blackline to sort of make this space beautiful. Our goal with Yukio is to make it a space that is comfortable, that is casual for now, but can morph into something finer as we grow and as we evolve our cuisine. I've made sort of no bones about the fact that I have ambitions for Yukio.
Well, tell me about your ambitions for Yukio.
Well, I initially started by saying that I really wanted it to be a very high-end restaurant. And I don't know what that means, but I know that I wanted it to have very technical food, very sort of complex food, lots of touches, lots of things like that, right? So really magnificent food. This recent spate of restaurant closings has certainly made me rethink this idea.
How so?
I'm just not sure people want it.
Well, we have that conversation usually when a restaurant closes. Well, they weren't ready for my cuisine or something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, I don't think it's a matter of being ready. I think it's about people not wanting it. There's nothing wrong with the Indianapolis diner. I mean, there are lots of people who are very sophisticated diners in this city. I know you can get frustrated when you close a place and you can say some things. And I've said these things in the past. You know, you get mad, you say things you don't mean. And, you know, the thing you want to say is, darn you, Indianapolis, why didn't you support me? Because that's how you feel. But there are people who are willing to come out and take a risk. You don't get places like Milktooth and Bluebeard and Rook, places that are, you know, that I think push the boundaries of their cuisine. They're being fully supported. You know, these are places that they have as free rein as they want to do the things they want to do.
And people have come along with them.
Right. So it's not fair to say that people aren't ready. And I didn't necessarily mean that. I think it's just that maybe they don't want certain things and they vote with their dollars. No one's going to walk into your restaurant and be like, we don't want this. Sorry.
So they're not going to tell you.
They're not going to tell you. Yeah, they're just not going to come back, right? And that's terrifying. So, yeah. So, you know, we are trying to evolve Yukio right now. We don't have to evolve it much. It's always meant to be a place that was going to be comfortable. And we don't want it to feel and look like a Japanese restaurant. That's what I do know.
Oh, no, that's interesting. So it's going to be a Japanese-inspired restaurant that doesn't
look like a Japanese restaurant? Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it's important to me for it not to be overtly Japanese. I'm not Japanese. I don't speak Japanese. Yeah, it needs to feel comfortable. It needs to, you know, you got to know your market. You got to know what people want. And we're going to try to keep it very affordable. Our goal is to stay in business long enough to give ourselves the opportunity to evolve.
We've been talking today with chef and restaurateur Neil Brown of Pizzology, Stella, the Libertine Liquor Bar, and the soon-to-come Yukio. For more information on Neil and his restaurants, check out neilbrownhospitality.com. I'm Jolene Katzenberger, and you've been listening to Eat, Drink, Indie Radio on WFYI HD2 The Point. Thank you so much for tuning in to our third anniversary show, and thanks also to our guests. Sherry Duggar, small farmer and media and outreach director for Indiana Farmers Union, and chef and restaurateur Neil Brown of Pizzology, Stella, the Libertine Liquor Bar, and the soon-to-open Yukio. And thanks also to producer John Katzenberger for helping to bring you Eat, Drink, Indie Radio.